whoever did this, I'm coming for you.
It was a brutal, brutal crime. A brutal homicide.
We were gonna fight tooth and nail to find out who did this.
When a beloved mother is murdered and a niece is left for dead, one woman vows to find the killer.
No one else was gonna go out there and do it.
But what happens when the person charged with the crimes is your own husband?
The whole family felt that she was covering up and she could have been in on it.
There was nothing that I could do to make this stop.
What happened?
It was hard to believe. I know in my heart they shot.
We had to find some answers.
Let it go and
reopen. Figure out who did that.
The investigation.
I needed just
the crucial information.
Never going
to
give up.
I had to do everything I could.
Sunday, June 7th, 1998. It's just past 2 a.m. in Barberton, Ohio, a sleepy suburb of Akron. And 58-year-old Judy Johnson has drifted off to sleep on her couch.
It was a very tiny home, one-bedroom home.
Just a few feet down the hall, Judy's 6-year-old granddaughter, Brooke, is sound asleep.
I've always thought of Brooke as one of my own children.
Meanwhile, a man is working the latch on the Johnsons' front door. Unfortunately, no one hears him as he slips into the living room. That is, until it's too late.
I can't imagine what you went through.
Early the next morning, 33-year-old Melinda Elkins is enjoying what seems like an ordinary Sunday at home with her husband Clarence and their two sons, Brandon and Clarence Jr.
The next thing we know, we heard someone flying up our driveway.
Cop cars were swarming up the driveway. The guys running down the hill in SWAT gear, coming from the side, both sides of the house.
Within seconds, a deputy sheriff barges in through their front door and orders them all to stay inside.
I was screaming at him to tell me what was wrong, because I couldn't imagine why they were even there. He asked me what my mom's name was, and I told him. I said, well, is she okay? And he said, no, ma'am, she's been murdered. I just bent over and I screamed.
Adding to the horror, the officer informs Melinda that her 6-year-old niece, Brooke, was found at a neighbor's house, where she ran to after being beaten, raped, and nearly strangled to death by the same man who killed Melinda's mother.
And I remember just doubling over in anguish. It was just unfathomable to think that someone would do that to my mother and to my niece.
Still, nothing could have prepared the family for what he says next.
The deputy sheriff had told me that my niece was claiming that her Uncle Clarence was the perpetrator. What? What do you mean Clarence is the suspect?
But when Melinda turns around, she's stunned to see her husband making a dash for the back door.
It seemed like a scene out of a movie. It was just unreal.
Outside, the SWAT team intercepts Clarence and throws him to the ground. Melinda's sons look on in shock as the cops handcuff their father and put him in a squad car.
Everything was just spinning out of control. I felt lost.
Time stood still for a second, and I started crying. It's like I kind of went into shock.
I can't imagine what he was going through at that point. The police wouldn't allow me to talk to him or even go near the car.
We all hugged, and we all were crying.
We were trying to comfort each other. We just didn't know what to do.
That same day, police charged Clarence Elkins with the rape and murder of Judy Johnson and the rape and assault of Brooke Sutton.
I was just heartsick and heartbroken in that instant, knowing that happened to my mom and my niece.
Still reeling from the news, Melinda heads over to her sister's house, hoping to speak to her niece. She's sure that Brooke has made an awful mistake. But as soon as the front door opens, Melinda realizes that her entire world has changed.
My Aunt Karen had screamed in the background, "Don't come up here."
Brooke had said that it was Uncle Clarence that attacked her. I mean, she was there. And she had been beaten and raped. She was up close and personal with this person. The family was in a state of disbelief and shock.
My brother-in-law came to the door and did not want to let me in. "Trust me," I said, "he did not do this." So I knew that there was an immediate separation of family at that point.
Holding her head high, Melinda attends her mother's funeral. It takes everything she has to face the family that believes her husband is a murderer and a rapist.
When I walked in, you could just feel how everybody didn't want to have any contact with me, you know, including my family.
I was just convinced that she knew that Clarence had killed Judy, and I didn't want to see her.
Me and my sons were abandoned.
Melinda is devastated, but nothing can match the heartache she's feeling over the sudden loss of her mother.
She was the one person in my whole entire life that I could go to about anything. We had a lot of hardships, and, you know, my mom made life fun.
Me and my grandmother were very close. I was feeling very hurt, sad, and I'd never get to see her again. I was very angry.
Standing at the funeral, Melinda makes a promise to her mother.
I was going to find out who did this.
The stakes couldn't be higher. Clarence is facing the death penalty. But Melinda has a daunting task. In order to clear her husband, she'll need to first identify another suspect. But she doesn't have the first clue as to who that suspect could be.
If it took me the rest of my life, I vowed to her I would find him.
When Clarence Elkins is accused of murdering his mother-in-law and raping his six-year-old niece, no one believes he is innocent, except for his wife, Melinda.
The whole family felt that she was covering up for Clarence and that she possibly could have been in on it.
And it seems that the police agree with the family. Detectives are convinced that the crime grew out of a long-standing hostility between Clarence and his mother-in-law, Judy.
Judy was always trying to get Melinda to leave Clarence and get a divorce.
Their contention was that we had such a bad marriage and that Clarence was tired of my mom meddling in our marriage, and he just snapped.
I was told that they argued and that he was mean to Melinda and mean to the kids. I wasn't surprised at the fact that he had done it.
We had a pretty stormy marriage, but our fights were nothing that included violence. Whatever problems we had nothing to do with my mom.
Melinda married Clarence, a press operator at a local steel mill, 17 years earlier. And although the relationship has had its ups and downs, the two have always been devoted to each other. In the community, Clarence is seen as a hardworking man and a good father with no criminal record whatsoever.
I've known him for 18 years of my life. You know, the first initial thought that was in my mind was he wasn't that type of person.
I know my father wouldn't have done this.
Still, Clarence's alibi is not ironclad. The attacks occurred between 2 and 5 a.m. Clarence was seen leaving a local bar at 2:30 that morning, and police believe he committed the crimes on his way home.
I did see him when he came home. We talked for about a half an hour, where he proceeded to go to bed. I stayed up.
Melinda swears that was no later than 3:30 a.m., leaving Clarence a very small window of time to commit the crimes. But police assume she's confused, or worse, is covering up for her husband. Melinda, however, remains undeterred.
I was going to prove to them that he didn't do it.
She starts by making a list of possible suspects.
I started my list with people who were in that area who had offenses that were violent or in sexual nature, people that could have come in contact with my mom, and I would check out Ohio Offender Search. I would also go to their cases that they had in court and look, you know, what it was about and what they did and if they were convicted or pled guilty.
Night after night, Melinda scours the internet looking for a clue. And then, one evening, she comes across two names that she recognizes.
Two people that I had on the list were from the Hicks adoption, which I was born in a clinic in Georgia, and the doctor was selling babies, and I was one of those babies, and it had come out about a year before.
Between the years 1951 and 1956, a Georgia doctor had sold as many as 200 babies on the black market to eager would-be parents who asked no questions. But recently, the story became public and received a great deal of publicity. Melinda, in turn, told reporters on many occasions that she was happy the adoption had brought her to a good home. But some of the other adoptees were disturbed to learn that they'd been removed from their birth families and expressed frustration with Melinda for defending the doctor and talking to the media.
A lot of people were not happy that this story came out.
Melinda can't help but wonder if someone related to the Hicks scandal could have been involved in her mother's death.
And this tremendous, tremendous fear had taken over me because I was wondering if they were after me.
But a hunch is not proof, and Melinda is determined to find concrete evidence that will help clear her husband's name. Then, just a few days later, there's a break in the case that looks as if it might do just that.
The defense did testing on hair that was left behind at the scene that didn't match Clarence, didn't match my mom, didn't match my niece. There's no physical evidence linking him to this crime.
But when Melinda checks in with her husband's legal team, her hopes are dashed. They explain that the hair from the crime scene could have belonged to anyone who'd visited the house. By itself, it proves nothing. Still, if Melinda can find an actual person whose DNA matches the DNA of the hair, that could make a serious dent in the prosecution's case.
I really, truly believe that this case hinged on DNA.
If she can secure DNA samples from the suspects on her list, perhaps one of them will match the anonymous profile from the crime scene.
I was actually tracking down these suspects that I had on my list and trying to gather DNA. I would go to the bar that they were at. I would either get a drinking glass if they went to the bathroom or a beer bottle. If they would put a cigarette out in the ashtray, I would retrieve that when they weren't looking, and then I'd slip off to the bathroom and make sure everything was secured, and then I'd leave immediately.
One by one, Melinda collects her samples, storing them at home for future testing. But it isn't long before her sons begin to question their mother's actions.
I was worried very much so for my mother's safety. I knew the real killer was still out there, and they would want to shut her up because she's the only one that was heading this investigation.
There were times that I put myself in a situation that I shouldn't have been in, but, you know, I was just totally focused.
But as Clarence's trial date approaches, Melinda still has nothing concrete to go on, and her husband is growing more anxious by the moment.
He was overwhelmed with bewilderment. He was worried about me and the boys. It angered me terribly that the killer was still out there and he was getting away with victimizing my entire family and murdering my mother. Whoever did this, I'm coming for you. I'm gonna find you.
For Melinda Elkins, life has become a waking nightmare. Her husband Clarence is on trial for rape and murder, and she seems to be the only one who believes he's innocent.
I was hoping for the best and preparing for the worst.
The prosecution's entire case is based on the sole eyewitness to the crimes, Melinda's six-year-old niece, Brooke.
They ask Brooke if the person was in the courtroom who hit her and assaulted her, and she said, yes, he is. And the prosecutor prompted her to point to that person, and she pointed to Clarence. I was definitely afraid at that point.
The jury deliberates for 15 hours before a verdict is finally reached. Clarence Elkins is convicted of murder and rape. He is sentenced to life in prison.
Clarence put his head down on the table. I just wanted to die. And they let him out of the courtroom. And I told him that I loved him. And he told me that he loved me. And I said to him, I'm not going to let them get away with this.
It just hurt so bad, and it was hard, very hard.
In the weeks and months following the trial, the family grapples with their anger and grief.
I fell into depression. I never wanted to go outside. I never wanted to go anywhere. I never wanted to do anything.
I was scared of what I was going to do next. I mean, how in the world was I going to make it through this?
But no matter how bleak the outlook, Melinda knows her only choice is to keep fighting.
I was setting out to prove everybody wrong.
She also has a new idea, and it's a simple one. Melinda will go back and interview all of the people closest to her mother. Maybe one of them will remember something that sheds light on the crimes. And it's not long before her idea pays off, with a tip that changes everything.
I had spoke to one of my mom's friends, and she wanted to come down and visit me and bring me a wedding tape that she had that my mom was in.
While watching the tape, Melinda notices a younger man dancing with her mother, someone she's never seen before.
I said, who is that guy?
His name is Bill Jones, a man from the neighborhood who apparently had a crush on Melinda's mother, Judy. The friend goes on to say that Jones asked Judy out on several occasions, but each time she gently brushed him off, reminding him that she was old enough to be his mother.
And I was like, what? I mean, could it be that my mom's rejection of him could have caused him to retaliate in a violent manner and commit this crime?
Melinda decides to pursue the lead on her own without telling the police. Technically, the case is closed, and so far, they've been reluctant to follow up on any of her suggestions.
There was opportunity, motive, and location. I started really questioning things about him.
Melinda hits the streets again, this time looking for anything that might shed light on Jones as a possible suspect. For a few days, no new information surfaces. Then, one of Judy's neighbors mentions an odd habit of Jones. Apparently, he's been known to carry around a broken pool cue. The news stops Melinda in her tracks.
The cue stick fit pretty well with the coroner's report of the blunt instrument that was used to hit my mom.
More convinced than ever that Jones is her mom's killer, she hires private investigator Martin Yant to take a closer look at the new suspect.
And there were some stories of unusual behavior, so that was obviously something that had to be pursued.
But Yant and Melinda both know that the only way to place Jones at the crime scene is a DNA sample. And that means one thing. Someone's gonna have to get close enough to procure it.
I was absolutely terrified, but I knew that I had to do it. No one else was gonna go out there and do it.
It's been more than a year since Melinda Elkins' husband, Clarence, was convicted of the brutal murder of her mother, Judy, and rape of her niece, Brooke. But Melinda is sure that he's innocent.
Clarence wasn't guilty and didn't deserve to be in prison, period. I was going to prove to them that he didn't do it.
Melinda believes the real killer may be Bill Jones. a local man who her mother rejected romantically not long before her death.
The feeling had come over me that he actually was guilty of this crime. I needed his DNA so we could have it tested.
But the police won't assist her.
I told Melinda that this was going to be an uphill battle. Instead of stepping back and expressing disappointment, she said, "I'm ready. Let's go. I want to find out who killed my mother, and I know Clarence didn't."
If I didn't keep pushing, no one else was going to keep it going.
Melinda has been secretly collecting DNA samples from suspects on her list for over a year. But Yant offers up a surprising new strategy. He suggests they confront Jones directly and ask point blank if he'll submit to a DNA test. If he says no, they'll know he's got something to hide. Together, Martin and Melinda go to Jones's house, expecting him to refuse their request. But to their surprise, he agrees.
Basing all the information and evidence that we had gathered on this guy, you know, I was hoping that it pointed to him.
Over the next few weeks, Melinda waits anxiously for the DNA lab report.
The test results came back. They did not match the alternative suspect. I was devastated by that.
With no new clues or leads, Yant sees only one option left. Melinda has to speak directly with the only eyewitness to the crime, her niece Brooke, who was also raped and left for dead. But there's a problem. Melinda has been cut off from her family since the day of the crime.
I was very hesitant, you know, because I didn't know what kind of reception I was going to get. I was scared.
She hesitated and then said, "Okay, we got to do it."
Terrified, Melinda makes the 35-mile trip to the home of her sister April, Brooke's mother, who she hasn't seen in over 3 years.
We walked up the front steps and knocked on the door, and my sister answered. And she kind of turned away from me, like she didn't want to talk to me. But then immediately turned back around, and she hugged me, and she was crying, and I was crying.
But there's still one more person Melinda needs to win over.
Brooke was there at the house, and I could see that she was kind of standing back, and then she just came running at me and hugged me and was crying, and again, I was crying, and I told her I loved her. And that was the greatest feeling that I had had since this whole nightmare began.
Brooke, now 9 years old, soon begins spending time again at her Aunt Melinda's house.
It wasn't like nothing had ever happened, but we had to start somewhere, to start piecing our family together.
As the weeks go by, Melinda waits patiently for an appropriate moment to engage her niece about the crime. Then, one day, she notices that Brooke is staring at a photo of Clarence on her fireplace. And soon after, the 9-year-old drops a bombshell.
She proceeds to tell her mom that she was looking at pictures of her Uncle Clarence and noticed that he had blue eyes, and that the person who hurt her had brown eyes.
Brooke goes on to explain that the killer and rapist did look like her Uncle Clarence. But now she doesn't think it was in fact him.
It felt validating. I had a breakthrough. She no longer believed that Clarence was the killer and the rapist.
A few weeks later, Brooke officially recants the testimony that sentenced her Uncle Clarence to life in prison.
I think that gave her a lot of hope that there was more information there. that Brooke could share with us and that we could break this case open.
I thought, well, maybe he didn't do it.
At that moment, Clarence was very strong and hopeful.
I felt that we were one step closer to getting my father home.
In October of 2002, Melinda petitions the judge who originally presided at Clarence's trial to reopen the case. But 6 months later, she gets a shocking phone call. The judge has denied Melinda's request for a new trial on the grounds that Brooke's recantation could have been coerced.
I was devastated. I felt like I had hit the biggest brick wall going 100 miles an hour.
Recantations are generally viewed very skeptically by the courts, particularly if it's a family type situation.
It was just a helpless situation at that moment. There was nothing that I could do to make this stop.
Then, at the end of 2003, Melinda has another idea.
I had learned that the Ohio Innocence Project was being started in Cincinnati, Ohio.
The Innocence Project is an organization devoted to helping free people who have been wrongfully convicted of crimes. With nothing to lose, Melinda calls its director, attorney Mark Godsey, and explains her case. He tells her that there are new technological advances in DNA testing that could help clear Clarence.
At the time this crime occurred in 1998, DNA testing was not as advanced as it is now. We now know with current advances that you can go back and find DNA where you couldn't a decade earlier.
The new technology will be able to test samples from the crime scene that the old technology couldn't pick up. The samples found on the bodies of Melinda's niece and mother could only have come from the man who raped them. If Clarence's DNA doesn't match, it will be definitive proof that he wasn't the rapist or murderer.
This was a case where there could be DNA that was overlooked originally that could conclusively prove whether Clarence was innocent or guilty.
It's been 5 years since Melinda Elkin's husband, Clarence, was sentenced to life in prison for rape and murder. But now, Melinda and attorney Mark Godsey are awaiting the results of a new series of cutting-edge DNA tests performed on bodily fluids found at the crime scene.
I wanted the whole world to see he was not guilty.
The findings leave Melinda breathless.
The results came back, and I was given a call from Mark. He said everything that was tested was viable, meaning that they did pick up male DNA and that it did not match Clarence whatsoever.
We were seeing a pattern of one man's DNA across several items in both victims that did not match Clarence Elkins. I knew at that point with absolute certainty that we had an innocent man.
I truly thought that would bring him home.
But the Elkins ordeal is not over yet.
The legal step is you have to file a motion in court for a new trial. If the judge grants it, then hopefully the prosecutor drops the charges and he goes home.
I thought, you know, this is it. How can they rebuttal DNA from a crime scene that doesn't match the person who's been convicted?
For 8 months, Melinda patiently waits for the judge's response. And in May 2005, it arrives.
I'm at work. I get a call. They have denied a new trial based on the fact the trial was not tried on DNA evidence, but an eyewitness. I broke down. I think, seriously, for the first time, I had lost all hope. I mean, this was our last shot.
I was afraid that my father would be in prison forever and we would never get to do the things that, you know, a father and son would do outside of the prison walls.
I had to explain to Clarence what had happened. No words can describe the silence that I got from the other end of the phone. He cried. And he said, I just don't understand.
This was a legal system, both prosecutor and a judge, who were resistant to acknowledging that a mistake had been made.
Melinda vows to locate the only evidence that can't be dismissed, the real killer.
This was a trying to find a needle in a haystack.
She has an unbelievable drive, and she wanted to solve this crime.
Melinda redoubles her efforts, researching similar offenses on the internet and in newspapers, looking for any clue that could lead her to a possible suspect. Then, one day, while reading an article, Melinda's pulse begins to race. It's about one of her mother's neighbors that Brooke went to for help the night of the crime.
And it went on to say that her common-law husband was being charged with child rape. And that's the first time that I had seen this name, Earl Mann, and read the charges, and it was an instant light bulb intuition feeling that went through me that said, this could be the guy.
Earl Mann had been in and out of prison for years, so Melinda always assumed her mother's neighbor lived alone. She now knows she has to get a DNA sample from him, but there's a problem. He's in prison again. So Melinda comes up with a new plan.
I started writing fictitious letters to Earl Mann as a pen pal. I came across as a lonely person who felt some type of connection with him and just wanted to help him and maybe send money and wanting him to lick the envelope and send it back to me so that I could have his DNA tested.
If Mann sends a licked envelope back to her, traces of his saliva will contain all the DNA Melinda needs for testing. During the next few months, she writes over 20 letters to Mann, but it's hopeless.
He never wrote me back. It was the only way I knew to get this guy's DNA.
It just seemed like it was not gonna happen.
But an unexpected event changes everything. Earl Mann is transferred to the same prison where Clarence is serving time.
That was miraculous. Out of 30-some prisons in Ohio, he lands in Mansfield with Clarence. I talked to Clarence a little bit about finding out who this guy is and if he knew him. And so he calls me back. He says, you're not going to believe this, but he's in the same pod as I am. It was just almost too good to be true that this could be the person, and he's right there in the same pod.
Now it's up to Clarence to get the DNA evidence. But Melinda knows what Mann is capable of, and she's worried.
I expressed to him that he had to keep it on the lowdown, and I was concerned about his safety.
This was a pretty despicable, unpredictable man. He had an extensive history of violence that seemed to be escalating at that time. He was just a totally out of control person. So it was very important that Clarence be careful.
For the next few weeks, Melinda waits to hear from Clarence, but he doesn't call, and she becomes desperate for news that he's all right. Then, one morning, Melinda picks up the phone and hears Clarence's voice on the other end. The first thing he says is, I got it.
They were in the pod with other inmates, and Earl Mann was smoking a cigarette, using the ashtray by himself, and put a cigarette out and walked back to his cell while Clarence was retrieving the cigarette butt with a tissue and went back to his cell, put it in a clean baggie, and stored it inside of his Bible.
Clarence hides the cigarette pressed tightly between the pages of his Bible. He has to make sure it's flat enough to send through the prison mail system without being detected by the guards. 2 weeks later, Clarence folds the DNA sample inside a letter, seals the envelope, and mails it to his attorney. For the first time in years, Melinda allows herself to hope.
I hope they find something. God, please let them find something.
It's been 7 years since the assaults that left her mother, Judy, dead, and her niece, Brooke, a rape victim. Now Melinda Elkins is waiting for the results of the DNA tests that she hopes will clear her husband, Clarence, of the crimes once and for all.
It was like holding your breath, you know, waiting for that moment. It was excruciating.
Then, in October 2005, after months of waiting, Melinda receives a call at work.
It was Clarence's attorney, and she said, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "It's a match."
The DNA from longtime violent felon Earl Mann is a direct match with the DNA samples taken from the victims at the crime scene.
When Clarence found out that it was a match, he said, "Thank God." Everything about this case was traumatic and devastating and unbelievable. Only this time it was a good unbelievable.
It sort of blew my mind.
I just started shaking and like, you know, this is it. My father's coming home.
Twice previously, the presiding judge had denied a motion to reopen the case. But this time, Melinda has proof of who the real killer is. She expects the judge and prosecutors to drop the charges against Clarence, but shockingly, they don't.
That was like a punch in the gut.
I'd already had an awful experience with these prosecutors and this judge, and I knew that we needed to sort of change the conversation.
To that end, Gotsi has a few tricks up his sleeve. His next move is to present the case directly to Ohio State Attorney General Jim Petro.
Wrongful conviction is a tragedy. We can't look at it any other way. And the only thing we can strive to do is seek justice and avoid compounding the error of wrongful conviction.
I was just blown away that a high-ranking official would do this for someone who's been convicted of murder and rape.
Once Jim Petro got involved, he did something absolutely unprecedented, I think, in the country. The top law enforcement official in the state of Ohio opposing the local county prosecutor.
The authorities were not going to give up their conviction. They were not going to admit a mistake.
We made a conscious decision to actually release that DNA evidence to the press and to the public on December 15th, 2005.
And sure enough, the tactic pays off.
Jim Petro tells me that the Summit County Prosecutor's Office were going to drop all charges against Clarence and have him released that day. I felt like a million pounds had been lifted off of me.
Melinda's next call is to Clarence, a call she's been waiting to make for 7 long years.
I said to him, "Are you ready to come home?" And he said, "I've been ready to come home." And I said, "Well, get your stuff packed because you're coming home today." And his reaction was, "Thank God. Thank everybody for everything they've done."
On December 15th, 2005, Clarence Elkins walks out of prison a free man again after serving more than 7 years of a life sentence.
I had a big smile on my face. I just couldn't stop smiling. To have my dad home again, it was awesome.
I don't think anything could surpass what that meant that day.
Earl Mann is charged with aggravated burglary, rape, attempted murder, and aggravated murder. It takes 3 years for prosecutors to build an airtight case against him. But in August of 2008, Mann finally pleads guilty to the crime and is sentenced to 55 years to life in prison. After years of struggle and heartache, Melinda, her family, and the world can finally reflect on what really happened on June 7th, 1998.
The night of the crime, Earl Mann snuck into the house. I think he went into the house to molest or to rape 6-year-old Brooke. Judy caught him. She began to do all that she could to stop him.
My mother was beaten to the point she had a broken neck. Her nose was broke. Her eye sockets were broke. Her cheeks were broke. She was strangled. She was raped. And she fought very hard. And my niece had heard a noise and came out and seen a man over top of my mom.
And she only got a very, very brief glimpse of the assailant.
And she ran back into the bedroom to hide. And he came in and he knocked her unconscious. My niece was strangled, raped, and beaten, and left for dead.
Brooke regained consciousness sometime early in the morning. She then went to the place she knew, two doors down, knocked on the door. Earl Mann's common-law wife answered the door. You have this bloody, beaten little girl on your doorstep. Like, it's very possible that Earl Mann was inside and they were trying to decide what to do with this little girl. She drove Brooke back to Brooke's own mother's home. It could have been such that she was asking her questions, well, what do you think the person looked like? And the girl might have said something like, well, it looked like my Uncle Clarence Elkins.
Brooke never knew that search for help would bring her to the doorstep of her perpetrator. To a traumatized 6-year-old girl, the mix-up is understandable. And neither Melinda nor Clarence blame Brooke for what happened.
I've always told her that it was not her fault. She was a child, and not to blame herself.
Today, Melinda and her family still bear the scars left by Earl Mann's crimes, but they are satisfied that justice was finally served.
Melinda Elkins is really a hero. She just never gave up.
To see a woman who went through all that she did finally be able to see the true killer of her mother identified, and to see her husband released from prison